Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 16 of The Creature from Beyond Infinity by Henry Kuttner, read by Mark Nelson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Creature from Beyond Infinity, Chapter 16, Thordred Strikes. During the 2 weeks of Court's unconsciousness, a great deal had happened. Many large cities, like Manhattan, had been evacuated. If many carriers had appeared at once, chaos might have been the result. But the plague came with comparative slowness at first. Martial law, of course, had been declared, resulting in less indirect mortality than might have been expected. The refugees faced neither starvation nor epidemic. With well-oiled speed, the federal government had swung into action. All over the country, the evacuated populations of such cities as New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and New Orleans were billeted in hospitable homes. But the danger remained. More and more of the carriers appeared. Shining, nebulous clouds of glowing fog, they slew by touch alone. There was no possible protection, for even lead armor was not always certain. Moreover, nobody knew the nature of these dread beings. Court racked his brain as he furiously drove on. Parts of the pattern were falling into place. Entropy, he thought, was the clue. The most puzzling problem was the apparent existence of an utterly alien element, the mysterious X. In a sane universe, this could not exist. It could not be alien. For a time, he pondered the Heisenberg uncertainty factor, but discarded it as a new idea came to him. The catalyst angle was perhaps the most logical one. Absently, he reached into the dashboard compartment, expecting to find cigarettes. There was a pack in it, nearly full. Court pressed in the dashboard cigarette lighter. Li Yang watched with interest. Court took the glowing lighter and held it to his cigarette. Abruptly, he paused, staring at the lighter. He whistled startledly under his breath. The Oriental blinked in astonishment. What an idea! Just an idea! A parallel, like conduction. Listen, Li Yang, if you take a red-hot chunk of steel and put it next to a cold piece, what'll happen? The cold piece will be warmed. Yes, the heat will be transmitted. Only it isn't heat in this case. It's X. X is being transmitted to living beings. Court rubbed his forehead. What is X? Energy? Sure, but... I've got it. He almost lost his grip on the wheel in his excitement. I've got it, Li Yang. Entropy, life, energy, cosmic evolution. "Words," said the Oriental, shrugging indifferently. "What do they mean?" Cort began to talk slowly, carefully, picking his way along the new theory. Evolution goes on constantly, you know. From the day the first amoeba was born, evolution kept on steadily. It'll always do that, all over this universe, and in other ones, too. Well, what's the ultimate evolution of life?
To what man is it given to know that? Li Yang replied fatalistically.
There have been lots of theories. Plenty of science fiction writers have speculated about it, people like Verne and Wells. Some of them say we'll evolve into bodiless brains. Well, that isn't quite logical. Rather, it doesn't go far enough. Brains are made of cellular tissue, and therefore can die. But thought, life energy, is the ultimate form. The final evolution is toward bodiless energy, life without form or shape. A gas, perhaps.
The Oriental nodded.
I think I see.
Well?
Cort swung the sedan around a curve, taking it wide to avoid an overturned roadster. Entropy goes on regardless. Eventually, a universe is destroyed. Matter itself breaks up. But this life energy isn't matter. It's left unchanged. It floats on through the void, like a dark nebula.
His eyes widened.
Perhaps that's the explanation for dark nebulae, like the coal sack, for example. Well, that doesn't matter. This cosmic cloud of life energy drifts through space. If it happens to reach a newly formed planet, like Earth billions of years ago, life is generated in the seas, and the cycle starts again. But if we already exists,
as on Earth now?
Yes, the chunk of hot steel warms the cold one. Only it isn't heat that's transmitted, it's pure life energy, the superlife, to which we'll all evolve at the end of our universe. We're not ready for that yet, but it's come of its own accord.
I am not sure I understand, Li Yang said thoughtfully.
Take a familiar parallel. We know today that there's a hormone which causes growth. A hormone is a glandular extract. If we inject an overdose of that into an infant, he'll grow enormously. But he'll probably be an idiot, with little control over his huge body. He should have been left to grow naturally, for he wasn't ready for the hormone in such a large dose. Neither is the Earth ready for so large a step forward in evolution. But we've got an overdose of pure life energy, and it's transforming human beings into another form of life.
Demons, Li Yang said quietly.
Perhaps, at least into poor devils. Well, that's the answer. But it still does not help matters.
Here's a town. I think it has an airport.
The field was a flurry of brightly lit activity. No carriers had yet appeared in this New Jersey city, but the air of tension was inevitable. By dint of argument, threats, pleas, and coercion, Cort managed to charter a plane, though he would have no success in getting a pilot. Their services were difficult to obtain because of the national emergency. It was lucky that Cort knew how to fly. He took time to drink black, scalding coffee at the airport restaurant, where curious glances were cast at his strange companions. There was little information he could gain from the scattered scraps of conversation. No one could guess where the plague might strike next. At the first sign of it, evacuation must take place, with the aid of every automobile, railroad, and plane that could be pressed into service. A few local residents wandered in to stare curiously at the unusual activity. Their lives would continue in normal routine until the plague actually arrived on their doorsteps. Refreshed, Cort took his companions into the plane, a speedy gyrocraft cabin ship. He felt grateful that he would not have to drive by car to Wisconsin. The trip would have necessitated a stop for sleeping, but in the plane he could reach his destination in 6 hours or so. Li Yang and Scipio were not startled by the air journey, for the golden spaceship had accustomed them to aerial travel. They watched with interest the countryside below. There was little chance to talk. The plane swept over Chicago, a desolate, evacuated metropolis. Chicagoans, Court had learned, were quartered all over Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, and even Ontario. Canada, of course, had thrown open its border. For days, crowded boats had been plying between Chicago and Benton Harbor in Michigan. The plague had not struck Milwaukee, however, though transportation facilities were held in readiness there. Actually, only a few cities had been disrupted, and plague deaths had been surprisingly few. The real peril, which not many knew, lay in the future, if the plague spread and remained incurable. At Madison, Court landed and rented a car. The headlights were pale spears stabbing through the gloom as the highway unrolled monotonously. Court was beginning to feel sleepy, but he had purchased some benzedrine sulfate in Madison. He gulped some of the stimulant, which refreshed him. In the back seat, Scipio polished his saber with an oiled rag he had found. Li Yang slept, choking and snoring, his head rolling ponderously in collars of fat. Now and again, Court caught sight of carriers, shining blobs of radiance that flashed toward them and were gone. What would happen if the car struck one? Would it rush through an impalpable glow, or would there be a catastrophic explosion of liberated energy? Court's mind felt so blurred that he could not think clearly. His hands ached and trembled on the wheel. His elbow joints were throbbing. The soles of his feet seemed to be on fire. But he could not stop and rest. Home was not far now, and even then there would be no peace. The road was familiar to him. Wisconsin lay under yellow moonlight, and beside the road the river flowed along silently. They topped a rise and came in sight of the village. It seemed unchanged, but as they swept through it, Court noticed the absence of lights and movements. The street was completely deserted. From the general store, a radio crackled inaudibly. On the store's porch was the body of a man in overalls, grotesquely sprawled. A dog slunk into view, stood frozen for a second, and then fled. Court thought with alarm of Marion Barton. Had she returned to the laboratory? Probably. But had she fled with the general exodus? Court's heart jumped as he saw a shining, shapeless glow drift into view from around a corner. A carrier. Another of the horrors was joining the first, but they made no effort to molest the speeding automobile. Court sucked in his breath. Once he reached the laboratory, all the weapons of his scientific career lay ready to his fingers. Then, knowing as he did the secret of the plague, he could fight, perhaps destroy the plague. And finally, Thordred. Marion could help. Her aid would be invaluable, if. "How much farther?" Scipio grunted from the back seat. Li Yang woke up and sleepily rubbed his eyes, yawning. "Almost there," Court said, a queer breathlessness in his voice. "Just over this rise. Hold on." A glowing shadow had loomed up sinisterly before the car, blocking the road. It was a carrier, silent, motionless, menacing. Court made a swift decision. He could drive straight at the thing, but that was too long a chance. Going so fast, though, he had little choice. He jammed on the brake, at the same time twisting the wheel. The car's tires rasped and screamed as the vehicle slid sideward. It rolled ominously on two wheels, righted itself, and plunged off the road. The occupants were jolted and flung about as the sedan lurched across a plowed field. A tire blew out with a deafening report. Desperately, Court fought the wheel. Bang! Another tire had gone, but Court jammed his foot on the accelerator. In the rear mirror, he could see that the carrier was still standing in the same place. It was not pursuing them. He got the car back on the road, picked up speed.
As it limped on, the carrier was left behind. Court drew a deep breath.
"Gods!" Scipio bellowed. "I almost stabbed myself with this blade!"
Li Yang gurgled with amusement.
"You are not as well padded as I, but I am glad our journey is almost over. It is it not, Court?"
"Yes, this is home."
Court's voice died away as he jerked the car to a halt. They were at the huge, rambling structure that had housed the laboratory. The building was gone. It had been razed to the ground in an irregular splotch of blackly charred ruin. A crater yawned among the debris. The laboratory was destroyed, and with it the chance to save the Earth. Sick hopelessness was so strong in Court that for a long, dreadful moment his heart was numb. He seemed to be dissociated from his body. As if he were a distant onlooker, he stared at the sharp clarity of the ruins under the moon, his shadow stretched out before him on the ochre pathway. On one side was the taller shadow of Scipio. On the other was the obese, dark blotch thrown by Li Yang's form. The grasses rustled dryly in the cool night wind. The embers were still warm, for smoke coiled up lazily from the dying coals. Apparently the work of destruction had occurred lately. Was it an accident? No, Thordred must be responsible. Court might have expected this. When Thordred acquired his memory pattern, he had also become familiar with the laboratory and all its potentialities. Naturally, he would wish to destroy it, lest use of its powers be used against him. But why had he waited 2 whole weeks? Perhaps because he had not been able to locate the laboratory until now. Despite having acquired Court's memories, Thordred was a stranger in this new, complicated civilization.
"Steve!"
The scream cut through the air, bringing Court around sharply. It was Marion's voice. Chapter 17. Marion. The cry came from the hillside beyond the house. For a second, Stephen caught the glimpse of a white figure running toward him in the bright moonlight. He raced to meet the girl. She collapsed in his arms, panting and disheveled. Her hair was a tumbled brown mass of ringlets. For several minutes she could only gasp inarticulately.
"Steve, thank God you're safe. I saw the headlights of a car, but I didn't know it was you. But I thought if you were alive you'd come back to the lab."
Looking down into her eyes, Court felt a queer tightness in his throat. He interrupted in a voice that was scarcely audible.
"Marion, I love you."
The girl caught her breath as she stared. Then suddenly she smiled with dazzling brilliance.
"I'm glad,"
she whispered, and pressed her head against Court's chest.
"I'm glad you're human after all."
Yes, Court thought to himself, he was human. For years he had refused to admit it. But now, a chuckle started behind his lips, he gloried in it. The others came running up, staring at Marion. She drew away from Court.
"Thordred wrecked the lab," she explained. "Who are these men?"
She eyed them inquisitively.
"No time for introductions now," Court snapped. "Tell me what's happened. You've seen Thordred, or you wouldn't know his name."
She nodded.
"He came here 2 hours ago and destroyed the house. I was the only one who got out alive. I saw the ship not far away. When I started to run, a beam of light flashed out, and I was paralyzed. A huge bearded man came running and carried me into the ship. He seemed to know who I was."
"Of course," Court agreed. "He acquired all my memories with his damned machine."
"There was a girl named Jansaya. She didn't say anything. She just watched. Thordred showed me dozens of men and women in the ship, asleep, cataleptic. He said he had captured them to start a new civilization. He was going to another planet, and he decided to take me, too. Since I'd been your assistant, Steve, he figured I'd be a good assistant for him. My scientific training would be invaluable to him. He told me you were dead, that he'd killed you with a ray in New York.
So he thinks I'm dead, Cort observed. That means he didn't know the ray only paralyzed me.
Marion didn't look at him as she continued.
I pretended to fall in love with Thordred's wishes, said I'd go with him. So he didn't bother to put me into catalepsy. He started the motors, and the ship began to rise. Then
Go on, Cort said gently.
He wasn't watching me. I saw what he was doing at the instrument panel, and I jumped at it. Somehow I pushed all the levers and buttons before he grabbed me. The ship crashed. I wanted to kill Thordred, Steve, because I thought he'd killed you. If you were dead, I didn't want to keep on living.
For an answer, Cort drew the girl closer. She went on talking hurriedly.
The ship was wrecked completely. It's right over the ridge. All the prisoners were killed, and Jansaya was hurt. I tried to help her, but Thordred dragged me away. I don't know how he got me out alive. He was like a madman. He salvaged some weapons from the wreck and made me go with him. I don't know why or what he intended. I think he wanted to kill me later, Steve, slowly.
Cort's face was chalk white. Clipping his words, he gave his orders. Let's find the ship. We may be able to salvage something, too. Li Yang, Scipio, watch out for Thordred, though I don't think he'll bother us now. The four mounted the slope. At the top of the ridge they halted. In the valley before them lay the vast golden bulk of the spaceship, near a streamlet that made a winding ribbon of quicksilver between its banks. There was no sign of life near the vessel. They descended the slope. Suddenly Marion cried out softly and gripped Cort's arm. The four halted abruptly. A shining oval drifted into view from behind a bush. It was a carrier, a glowing fog, fading toward its edges into invisibility. With more than human speed it moved toward the group. Cort instinctively thrust the girl behind him. Scipio lifted his hard fist in futile defiance. Then he remembered the saber and drew it. But there was no defense against a carrier, Cort knew. He opened his mouth to shout a command to flee, but for some reason that he could not define, he waited. The shining thing halted. It was motionless, and Cort was conscious of an intent regard. The creature was watching him. Why? Such a thing had never happened before. Always the carrier had leaped eagerly, avidly upon then prey. Why did this horror wait? Cort inexplicably felt something stir and move in his brain. Briefly, the image of old Sammy, with his brown wrinkled face and his mop of white hair, rose up vividly in his mind. Behind him, Marion's voice whispered like a prayer.
Sammy!
The shining thing seemed to hear. It hesitated and drew back. Suddenly it turned, speeding up the slope, and vanished over the ridge.
Good God! Cort whispered through dry lips. Marion, do you think that was Sammy?
White-faced, the girl nodded.
Yes, Steve, and I think he knew us, remembered us. That's why—
She could not go on. Well, Scipio broke in roughly, why do we wait? Let's go on. In silence, Cort led the way down the slope. Presently he shivered a little, and Marion glanced sharply at him.
Do you feel that, too?
What? Wait a minute. Yes, some radiation.
There,
Li Yang said, pointing. Cort followed the gesture, saw the spot of light. Blazing like the heart of a blue sun, flaming with a fierce and terrible radiance, the light speck glowed upon the hull of the ship. Instantly, Cort guessed what it was. The atomic energy that powered the huge motors had broken free. No longer prisoned by its guarding, resistant sheath, it was sending its powerful vibrations out like ripples widening on a pool.
Don't go any closer. Cort clutched Scipio's arm, halting him. That's dangerous. It can fry us to a crisp.
Gods! The Carthaginian stared. Is that true? A mere glow of light?
In theory, Cort knew something of atomic energy, though it had never been achieved practically on Earth. In the old days, men had feared that unleashed atomic energy would destroy the whole planet, its fiery breath spreading swiftly like a poisonous infection. But Cort knew there was no sign of that. The rate of matter consumption was far too slow. In 1,000 years, the valley might be eaten away, but not in 5 years or 5 minutes.
Scipio!
The faint cry came from nearby, startling them. The Carthaginian's hand flew to his sword as he whispered,
"Jansaya!"
And again came the cry, plaintive, gull-sweet, infinitely sad,
"Help me!"
With a muttered oath, Scipio whirled and ran. Cort followed at his heels. A mound of bushes clustered 100 feet away, and in its shelter lay Jansaya. The fading moonlight washed her hair with gold. She lay broken, dying.
"Jansaya," Scipio said tonelessly. He dropped to his knees beside the girl and lifted her in his mighty arms. With a tired sigh, she let her head fall on his bronze shoulder.
My back."
After Cort completed a hasty examination, his eyes met Scipio's. He did not need to speak, for the Carthaginian nodded slowly. Jansaya's torn gown and bruised limbs told how she had dragged herself toward safety.
"Thordred left you?"
Scipio asked in a queer, hoarse voice. The strangely beautiful green eyes misted with pain as she held herself close to Scipio's barrel chest. The Carthaginian's gargoyle face was the color and hardness of granite in the moonlight.
I think I might have loved you, warrior," Jansaya murmured.
Then she sobbed restrainedly with unbearable agony. The golden lashes drooped to shield the sea-green eyes. The tender lips scarcely moved as the girl whispered,
"There was not ever any pain in old Atlantis."
Her head drooped on his arm and was motionless. Gently, Scipio laid her in the shelter of the bushes. He touched her hair, her eyes, then tenderly he touched his lips to those red, silent ones, from which even the faint hint of cruelty had gone. As he drew back, the last glow of the sinking moon failed. The eternal dark accepted Jansaya and shrouded her. The starlight was cold as glittering ice on Scipio's savage eyes as he rose. He stood towering there, motionless, staring at nothingness. Slowly he turned to face the west.
"Cort," he rumbled distantly,
"you heard her?"
"Yes,"
Cort said in a low, tense voice.
"He left her to die."
Abruptly, the Carthaginian's face was that of a blood-ravening demon, the mighty hands flexed into talons.
"He is mine to slay,"
Scipio breathed through flaring nostrils.
"Remember that. He is mine to slay."
But Jansaya could no longer hear. She lay limp, slim and lovely, and forever untouchable now, shielded from all hurt. She slept as a child might sleep.
"You wish to kill me?" a harsh voice asked mockingly. "Well, I am waiting, Scipio."
From the shadows of the bushes, Thordred's giant form rose into view. Startled bewilderment momentarily paralyzed Cort. He cursed himself for a fool. He might have expected this, but finding Jansaya had made him relax his vigilance. Glaring at Thordred, he stepped aside to stand in front of Marion. Li Yang's fat yellow face was expressionless. Scipio, after one hoarse oath, had drawn his saber. He was walking forward, his eyes burning with blood hunger.
Thordred's hand dipped into his garments, came up holding a lens-shaped crystal that shot forth a spear of green light. It touched Scipio. The Carthaginian halted in mid-stride, with the saber lifted, a grin of fury frozen on the gargoyle face. Court leaped for Thordred, but the green ray caught him too. The life was drained from him in a shock of icy cold. He stood motionless, paralyzed, as the ray darted aside. From the corner of his eye, Court saw Marion and Li Yang stiffen into immobility. The four stood helpless, while Thordred tossed his crystal from hand to hand and grinned. "You fools!" his harsh voice grated. "So I did not kill you that other time, did I, Court? Well, I shall rectify that omission now. If not for the interference of all of you, I should never have lost the ship. Yet I can still have my vengeance." He glanced down significantly at the lens he held. "You shall die slowly, in the utmost agony. You shall burn gradually as I increase the strength of the ray. After that, I do not know what I shall do. Perhaps I can build another ship. The knowledge I have stolen should enable me to do that. But that comes after my revenge." The bearded face was murderous in the moonlight. The crystal flashed a ray that struck Court on the chest. The green light turned yellow. Simultaneously, blinding pain racked the man. He smelled the odor of his own burning flesh. "You shall die," Thordred gritted. "All of you, this is my vengeance." Chapter 18. The Man Who Lived Again. When Thordred placed Ardath's body in the small spaceship and sent it hurtling toward the sun, he had thought the Kyrian dead. His fear of Ardath's giant intellect had been so great that he would feel safe only when the solar inferno had utterly consumed it. Yet, by making doubly sure that his former master would meet death, Thordred had committed a serious error. For Ardath was not dead. He awoke slowly, painfully, only vaguely conscious of his surroundings. For a time he lay quietly, blinking and striving to understand. He kept his eyes closed after a single glance at a dazzling glare. He turned his head away from the bright light and reopened his eyes. His gaze took in his surroundings. He was in a spaceship, a small one that was unfamiliar to him. Through the ports in the walls showed the starlit blackness of interplanetary space. He was incredibly weak. He sat up, massaging his limbs until his numbed circulation was restored to normal. Then he rose with a great effort and looked around. Sunlight flamed through a row of ports. Ardath instantly realized that he was falling directly into the rapidly enlarging sun. He saw the controls, sprang toward them, almost collapsing in his weakness. He examined the unfamiliar apparatus, tentatively fingering the panel. Presently, the puzzle of strangeness was solved in his amazingly swift mind. He tried a lever, then another, and knew that he was master of the unknown ship. The vital problem just now was to escape the sun's attraction. Luckily, he was not yet even close to the chromosphere. He turned the vessel in a wide arc. After staring through the ports, he aimed its nose at Earth. Then he locked the controls and searched for food. Foreseeing emergencies, Court had stocked the little ship well. Much of the food was unfamiliar to Ardath, but he sampled it intelligently. Brandy stimulated him and gave him strength. As he ate, he pondered the situation. How had he got here? What had awakened him from his cataleptic sleep? The last thing he remembered was emerging from the laboratory in his own ship to encounter Thordred's ruthless blow. The bearded giant had betrayed him, but how long ago had that been? How long had Ardath slept? During his last period of awakening, He had arranged an automatic alarm which would react to the presence of any unusual mentality existing on Earth. Ardath wished to take no chances of sleeping past the lifetimes of geniuses. But he had not had time to set that alarm before Thordred stunned him. Everyone in the Golden Ship should have slept on until infinity, unless awakened by some outside force. What had that been? Again Ardath went to a port and studied the constellations, noting the changes that time had made. He computed roughly that at least 20 centuries had elapsed since his last awakening. Perhaps, through his failure to set the automatic alarm, he had already slept through the lifetimes of innumerable supermentalities. Though Ardath did not know it, of course, he had not awakened to find Moses, Confucius, Socrates, Galileo, Newton, and a dozen others. The alarm, had it been set, would have aroused him when those men appeared on Earth. Ardath glanced thoughtfully toward the sun. Its powerful rays, unshielded by any atmosphere, had awakened him. He felt gratitude to the unknown builder of this ship, who had installed transparent ports through which the vital radiations had poured. If the vessel had been on any other course, Ardath might have slept on to the end of time. But the sun's rays had destroyed the artificial catalepsy. Ardath rose and began to search the little ship. Its architecture was obviously terrestrial, the natural development of art forms he had seen in ancient days on Earth. Moreover, the use of earth metals in the construction, and the absence of any unusual ones, confirmed this theory. Certain equipment that Ardath found interested him. The mystery of a blowtorch he solved without difficulty. An electromagnet and vials of acids made him nod thoughtfully. When he measured one of the ports carefully, he realized that it coincided exactly with the size and shape of the entry ports on his own ship. The equipment indicated that the unknown owner of this little vessel had expected to find a barrier difficult to pass. The curious similarity of the ports on both ships added up to an unescapable conclusion. Someone on Earth had built this ship in order to reach and enter Ardath's craft. Obviously, he had succeeded, but without the use of atomic energy. He had duplicated the alloy that coated the hull of the Kyrian vessel, yet the energy was electrical in nature. Ardath's race had used electricity once, so many eons ago that it was mere legend when he had been born. Atomic energy had supplanted it. Yet Ardath must work with the tools at hand. He found himself experiencing difficulty in breathing. The air supply, of course, had not bothered him during his cataleptic state, but now it was becoming a problem. He examined the air renewers and purifiers, found them simple but effective. Luckily, there were the necessary chemicals aboard the ship to renew the exhausted apparatus. The names on the containers meant nothing to Ardath, but the chemicals were easily recognizable. In only one case did he find a test necessary. It would be a long journey back to Earth. Meanwhile, Ardath examined some maps and charts that had been in a cupboard, as well as a popular novel which one of the workmen who built the ship had left in a corner and forgotten. These would be invaluable for learning the language. Since Ardath already knew Latin from his last period of awakening, he could learn English without too much difficulty. He could even approximate the present pronunciation, once he understood the letters, like W, which Romans did not have. The luckiest find of all, after all, was a newspaper. Two problems faced Ardath. He must find his own ship, and he needed a weapon. Painstakingly, he analyzed the situation. Day after day dragged on while the spaceship fled toward Earth. The Kyrian studied the charts, the book, and the newspaper, striving to understand. From a rubber stamp on the maps, he learned that the owner of the vessel was named Stephen Court, and that he lived in Wisconsin, near a town which Ardeth finally located on one of the charts. That became his destination. The Kyrian's keen understanding of psychology aided him in understanding what had happened during his unconsciousness. Placing himself in the respective positions of Thordred and Stephen Court, he applied rules of logic. When Court had entered the golden spaceship and found the cataleptic bodies, he would naturally have tried to awaken them. When he awoke Thordred, what had happened? There were two possibilities. Thordred, Ardath realized now, wanted power above all else. He had resented the Kyrian's domination. After apparently succeeding in killing his former master, he would not have been willing to obey Court. Rather, his lust for power would have been given fresh fuel. He and Court would have become either enemies or friends. In the latter case, Ardath now faced two opponents. But why should Court, having built this ingenious and expensive spaceship, have been willing to destroy it by aiming it at the sun? He would naturally have wished to retain it for later use. A logical man does not destroy valuable equipment, and only a logical and intelligent person could have built this vessel. But Thordred, on the other hand, would have wished the smaller ship destroyed, so that he would possess the only spaceship on Earth. Such tactics would strengthen his power, unless there were already other spacecraft in existence. That was impossible. This one was obviously patterned on Ardath's own vessel. A man with sufficient knowledge to create it would have used it, first of all, to visit the original ship. That sounded logical, though not entirely certain. Court would probably have resented the destruction of his property. That indicated that he and Thordred were enemies. But from that conclusion, Ardath could go no further. He could only wait until he had reached Earth and visited the home of Stephen Court in Wisconsin. If Court lived, he would certainly be an ally. And now Ardath concentrated on creating a weapon. Equipment was at hand, and electricity. Atomic energy Ardath could not manufacture at present, but he thought it would not be necessary. Already he had a plan for a weapon in mind. It must be able to convey a strong shock, or even a fatal one, over quite a distance. That necessitated some conductor of the current. A jet of water, a thin spray perhaps, might do the trick. But the use of ordinary water was not quite satisfactory. Ardath began to experiment with the limited laboratory he had at his command. He worked arduously, sleeping and eating only when he found time, while the ship sped toward its destination. Earth grew from a star to a spinning globe, cloud-sheathed, and then into a vast concave disk that blotted out the starry void. Ardath found the outline of North America, checked it with his maps. Then he sent the vessel arrowing toward Lake Michigan, which was visible even from beyond the atmosphere. It was night before he landed outside the village near Court's home. He lowered the ship silently among the concealing trees and slipped toward the lights of the settlement. His clothing would arouse curiosity, he realized, but that could not be helped. Taking his new weapon, which was awkwardly bulky, he moved forward. Luck was with him. A youth, idling along the highway in a dim stretch, paused to stare at Ardath. The Kyrian took advantage of the opportunity. Mouthing the unfamiliar words carefully, he asked, "Can you say where Stephen Court lives?" It sounded like, "Can Yoa say where Stephen Court lives?" The boy blinked. "Sure. You're a foreigner, ain't you?" When no answer came, he went on pointing. "Right up the road there," he gave explicit directions. "But I wouldn't go up there if I was you. There was a fire up there just a little while ago, and folks saw some funny kind of airship hanging around. They think it crashed in the valley behind the house, but nobody's gone to look. We stay away from Court's place, since he had a case of the plague there." Without a word, Ardath left the lad and hurried on. He had understood most of what had been said. A funny kind of airship. Could that be the golden space vessel? By the gods, if it had crashed! The ruins of the house told their own story. Ardath hesitated, then skirted it to climb up the slope beyond the charred foundations. The valley behind the house, the boy had said. Ardath topped the ridge. His thin, patrician face went cold as marble at the sight before him. The ship was wrecked, he saw at a glance. And he saw, too, the moonlit figures of huge Thordred and his paralyzed prisoners. As the ray flashed out from the lens in Thordred's hand, Ardath ran swiftly down the slope, concealing himself amid the bushes. As an odor of charred flesh came to his nostrils, his eyes were suddenly remorseless as death. At last he was close enough. He rose from the shadows and called softly, "Thordred!" The bearded giant whirled, shocked amazement in the amber eyes. The yellow ray swung wide, out of his control. Simultaneously, Ardath lifted the weapon he held, and a thin jet of fluid shot from its muzzle, splashing on Thordred's arm. The giant yelled in agony, and his lens fell to the ground. "You betrayed me, Thordred," Ardath said emotionlessly. "It is just that you die." He stepped forward. The huge bearded figure swayed and writhed in agony, striving to break free from the invisible grip that held it. Ardath's foot slipped on a rounded stone. For a second, the liquid jet wavered from its mark, but swept back swiftly. Thordred was gone. He flung himself back into the shelter of the bushes. The crashing of the underbrush told of his flight. Ardath shrugged and lowered his weapon. "He is harmless now," he said, and bent to pick up the lens. Briefly, he eyed the three men and the girl, still paralyzed. Scipio, Li Yang, and two strangers. He made a hasty adjustment on the crystal, sent a blue glow sweeping out to bathe the four. The paralysis fled. "Ardath," Li Yang said. "You came in good time." "By the gods, yes!" Scipio roared. His voice went soft with regret. "Though not in time to save Jansaya." His eyes clouded. Lifting his saber, he plunged forward. "I'll be back with Thordred's head," he promised over his shoulder, and vanished into the woods.
You're Ardath?" Cord asked.
The burn on his chest was aching painfully, but it was not deep, and it had been automatically cauterized. He stared at the rescuer. The Kyrian nodded. "I am Ardath. You seem to know of me. Are you Stephen Court?"
"Yes, but how did you learn English? How did you escape from the sun trap? What—"
"Wait." Ardath was staring down at the wrecked ship. "Before all else, the atomic energy must be prisoned again. It is—he fumbled for the right word—dangerous. To approach it closely means death."
"Lead?" Court suggested.
When Ardath looked puzzled, he gave the atomic number.
"Only a special alloy will insulate the rays of atomic energy. Do you see that container? It looks like a speck from here, beside the spot of light. Only that can hold the power."
He frowned.
"The power must be placed in its sheath again. But—"
"It means death," Li Yang broke in.
"Very well, I shall do it."
Court clutched the fat arm.
"You need not sacrifice yourself."
Ardath's face was expressionless as he went on in his painful, stilted English.
"Whoever goes must be quick. The rays kill swiftly. Hurry to the ship, slide the container over the little globe of atomic energy, and put the cover in place. That is all. After that, it will be safe to approach."
"Steve," Marion said unsteadily, "let me go."
"No!"
Court's arm went around the girl, drawing her close.
"Not you. Do we need to make this sacrifice, Ardath?"
The Kyrian nodded sorrowfully. "The energy will spread out till it touches ores. Then it will expand faster, until the Earth itself will be destroyed." There was a sudden interruption. From the bushes behind the group a glowing nimbus of light drifted. It was a carrier, but it did not approach the three. Instead, it sped down the slope toward the ship. Ardath stared.
"Marion, do you suppose—" Cort said hoarsely. "Maybe, Steve. If that was Sammy, he may have heard us."
They watched as the weird carrier fled toward the ship. It reached the hull, bent over, and picked up a small object from the ground. It made a swift motion, and the glare of atomic energy vanished.
"He did hear us!" Cort exulted. "Good old Sammy!"
The light nimbus was drifting away toward the other side of the valley. Presently it was hidden from sight, but before that Ardath was striding down to the ship. He returned, holding in his hands an oval container of dark, lustrous metal. It was the sheath for the atomic energy.
"We have much to talk about," he said to Cort. "Your language, I must master it better."
Scipio came back, cursing and swinging his saber. His deep chest rose and fell as he panted.
"Thordred got away. I could not catch him."
Cort took immediate command. "Back to the road. There's plenty of room in the car. We'll head directly for Washington and make plans. I think you can help us against the plague, Ardath. Your atomic energy has already given me an idea."
"The plague?" Ardath asked. "I'll help if I can, but I am sorry you did not destroy Thordred, Scipio. I fear he will trouble us again."
The Carthaginian did not answer. He grinned unpleasantly, fingering the saber blade as he followed the others back toward the ridge. End of chapter 18. Chapter 19 of The Creature from Beyond Infinity by Henry Cuttner. Read by Mark Nelson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Creature from Beyond Infinity, Chapter 19, The Earth Shield. 2 weeks later found Cort haggard and red-eyed with exhaustion. He and Ardath, aided by Li Yang, Scipio, and Marion, had been working day and night, experimenting, testing, discarding. Cort's task had been complicated by the difficulty of securing the government's backing. The President, though in favor of Cort's proposal, would not give his consent until the country's foremost scientists had approved.
"They still don't realize what we're up against," Cort told Marion. The two were walking toward a huge white auditorium on Pennsylvania Avenue.
The dome of the Capitol loomed against the blue sky. A number of cars were drawn up before the marble building.
"But they know what the plague's doing," Marion said worriedly. "New cases every day."
"I know. Perhaps I shouldn't have asked for as much money as I did. Yet we'll need it all. Small weapons aren't enough. We've got to build the shield to save Earth."
"Well, today's the day," she mused. "All the scientists will be there, with lots of army officials and Washington bigwigs."
Cort smiled.
"Yes, I hope."
He turned into an alcove and picked up a phone. Presently he asked, "Scipio? All set?"
"Good. Be careful now."
He turned back to Marion.
"This may be dangerous, but I think it'll do the trick."
Before long he was on the stage of the auditorium, a lithe, well-built figure against a background of sable curtains. The room was nearly filled with a crowd of men, scientists, uniformed army men, politicians. A rustle of expectancy went through them as Cort appeared. Without preamble, he began.
"I am going to ask you to witness—"
He paused as reporters' flashlight bulbs popped and glared.
All right, boys. Save some of your plates till later. You will need them. To resume, I am going to perform an experiment for you today. Most of you are already familiar with my proposal. I have found a cure for the plague, but it is an expensive one. On the other hand, it is the only possible way to save the human race from extinction."
"Bunk!" a voice yelled. "Prove it!"
Cort lifted his hand.
"One moment. You have all read about our death. Some of you, I think, have seen my colleague. His strange history has become familiar to you. Let me introduce him now."
Ardath walked out on the platform. His antique clothing had been replaced by a well-fitting suit of light flannels, and his slim figure went over to stand beside Cort. The lean patrician face looked out over the audience without expression.
"Fake!"
a cry arose. It was echoed by others. A gray-haired man stood up.
"If you have found a cure for the plague, prove it. This Ardath may be an impostor. He probably is. He has nothing to do with—"
Ardath did not say a word, but he stepped forward a pace. Something in the look of the strange alien eyes brought silence to the auditorium. In the stillness, Cort spoke again.
"You know that the plague is fatal. To touch a carrier is instant death. That there is no possible insulation. I have already given my theories about the origin of the plague. It is sheer life energy, the ultimate evolution of all life, the residuum of some immeasurably ancient universe that evolved into pure energy perhaps eons ago. This cosmic cloud of energy has drifted through the interstellar void until its edges infringe upon the Earth. Some catalyst in our atmosphere made it potent, infected our me-forms with this strange virus. What the plague does is simply this. It speeds up entropy. And the evolution that takes place is abnormal, against nature."
Cort paused, drew a deep breath, and resumed.
"Normal evolution is slow. Mankind automatically adjusts itself to different environments through the course of ages. But this is a sudden jump to the ultimate life form, which in the normal course of events should not exist in this system for billions of years. That disrupts the evolutionary check and balance system. Humanity is not yet ready for this metamorphosis. It must come slowly and gradually, over a period of millions of years. Let me sketch for you the future. More and more of the carriers will appear as Earth plunges deeper into the heart of the cloud of life energy. The carriers will feed on those who were once their fellows. Eventually, only they will exist on this planet, and even they will die in the end for lack of sustenance. In less than 50 years, the world will be a barren, dead sphere drifting through space. That is what it might have been had we not found a cure."
Then the Kyrian's clipped, precise voice rang through the auditorium.
"Cort speaks truly. You men of this civilization are strange to me. Perhaps few of you believe the story of my origin. That does not matter. Working together, Cort and I have discovered the nature of the plague and found a solution. It is this. The carriers are forms of me energy. They can be destroyed, but only by creating a stronger type of energy which will drain their own. Only one thing will do that: atomic power. A certain carrier came in touch with the unguarded atomic power in my spaceship. Later, we searched for him and found his body near the vessel. Exposure to the terrific energy had killed him."
Cort nodded, remembering how he and Ardath had hunted through the Wisconsin hills for Sammy, and the burned, inhuman thing they had found at last. The Kyrian went on.
"Atomic power short-circuits the carriers, drains their energy. Already we have constructed portable weapons which are thoroughly satisfactory.
"But the life cloud in space," a voice from the audience broke in. "You can't destroy that."
The Kyrian smiled grimly.
"True. And more carriers will appear as we approach the nucleus of the cloud. But we can protect Earth, create a wall around it, a shell of atomic energy. With the right machines, we can transform the Heaviside layer into a shield that will perfectly insulate this planet against the cosmic cloud. Solar radiation will still come through unchecked, but not a trace of the deadly life energy will be able to penetrate the shield."
A low murmuring in the auditorium grew into a roar. Men rose and shouted questions, challenges at Ardath.
A shield around the Earth? Ridiculous. Such fantastic pipe dreams belonged with perpetual motion and other exploded theories.
Ardath glanced wryly at Quart.
"Well, I see I can't convince them. Shall we?"
Quart was waving his arms, trying to quiet the crowd. His attempts were useless. Already some of the audience were rising and heading for the exits. No one saw Quart wave toward the wings, but all eyes turned to the stage when the black curtain rustled apart. Simultaneously, a gasp of sheer horror ripped from hundreds of throats. On the platform was a carrier. A huge box of luminous metal stood just behind it, in which the horror had apparently been confined. It was open now, and the luminous fog that constituted the carrier was drifting forward with purposeful intent. Ardath and Quart had raced to one side of the stage. Scipio appeared, wheeling a small contrivance no larger than a dictaphone. A conical tube topped it, ending in a translucent lens.
"Good," Quart snapped at the Carthaginian. "But for God's sake, be careful now."
The giant nodded with a flash of white teeth. Quart turned to the paralyzed audience.
"Stay where you are. There is no danger unless you get hysterical and riot."
A uniformed man in the aisle shouted an oath and whipped out his revolver. He pumped bullets at the glowing creature. Naturally, there was no result. Quart waited till the echoes had died.
"No one will deny that this is an authentic carrier. Watch."
The creature was at the edge of the platform when Scipio swung his weapon to focus upon it. The result was unspectacular. A ray of intense white light struck from the lens, and the glow surrounding the carrier merely began to fade. The thing remained motionless, all its glory dulling. At last, there was only something like a mummy collapsing to lie motionless on the stage. Scipio switched off the light.
"Take your seats, please," Quart said. "I have no more surprises for you. I shall welcome a committee to examine the body of this carrier."
The first man to hasten down the aisle was a strongly built, handsome man with grizzled gray hair. He went directly to Quart.
"Mr. President," Quart cried, "I didn't know you intended to be here, or I wouldn't have—"
"I'm glad you did make that experiment," said the President of the United States. "I doubt if the scientists will fail to approve your plan now."
There was a little twinkle in the level gray eyes.
"Even if they do, I have authority under martial law to order you to build your Earth shield and to give you every assistance you require."
The big figure turned toward the audience, and the President waved at the group of reporters.
"Put that on your front pages, boys. Stephen Quart's in charge."
With silent, incredible speed, Earth swung into action to fight the cosmic menace. Stephen Quart was in charge. Beside him, Ardath worked, untiring, unsparing of himself. Li Yang, Scipio, and Miriam Barton lent their aid. Staffs of trained scientists gathered from all over the world. Factories were hastily commandeered and their machinery altered so they could turn out quantities of the atomic energy portable guns. From San Francisco to New York, from New Orleans to Chicago, trained men went busily to work. Production of the guns was left to subordinates. Once provided with the plans, they executed their orders with swift precision. Troops of militia were armed with the weapons and sent into plague-infested areas. New York was cleared of the carriers, and the other cities as well. Dozens of the guns were stored in airports, ready for instant transportation whenever a case of the plague was reported. Such reports were constant these days. Earth was approaching dangerously close to the nucleus of the cosmic cloud. Ardath flew to China with Li Yang and 200 famous scientists. A job had to be done there. Two gigantic towers had to be erected, on each side of the Earth, one in the Orient, one in America. Court was in charge of constructing the latter. He remained in constant telephonic communication with Ardath. Speed was essential. Every resource of the country was turned to building the Earth Shield. Business was neglected. The government issued their orders, delegating certain jobs to certain groups. The people had to be fed, of course, but every capable man was mustered to the task for which he was best fitted. Factories worked day and night. Every other country lent its aid. Canada, England, Germany, France, Italy, Japan, all forgot their imperialistic and trade quarrels in order to battle the common enemy. There was no time for war. Build the towers, create the Earth Shield, these aims were foremost. Slowly, the mighty obelisks rose. They resembled the Eiffel Tower, but were far taller and larger. Immense girders buckled huger beams together as the monoliths rose against the sky day by day. Faster, faster the men worked. At night, searchlights were used. New roads were built and old ones widened, all converging on the towers. A railroad was laid to each one from the nearest line. Nearby towns found themselves incredibly augmented in populations. Emergency barracks rose. Dapper physicists and chemists slept side by side with burly roustabouts and riveters. No thought of class and few quarrels rose. Each man knew that the plague might strike his own family next. Under his breath, he whispered, "Build the Earth Shield! Hurry! Hurry!" Two towers loomed at last, visible for many miles. Each one was topped with a shimmering, bright sphere of metal 50 feet in diameter. From these globes the atomic energy would flame out, to encircle the planet and transform the atomic structure of the Heaviside layer into an impregnable barrier. Chapter 20. Thordrid Returns. Court had little time to rest. He had frequent reports from the chief of the FBI, whom he had requested to track down the vanished Thordrid. But the bearded giant had disappeared without a trace. His continued presence meant danger, however. Thordrid possessed the knowledge he had stolen from the minds of both Ardath and Court. The dragnet searched for him vainly. One night, Court, Scipio, and Marion stood in the control room just beneath the huge globe that topped the tower. The task was finished. The last workman had just departed in the elevator that led to the ground. The three stood quietly, staring out at the land that stretched far beneath them. Bright moonlight bathed everything weirdly, yet beautifully. The room was 50 feet square, a flat platform around which a low railing ran. There were no walls. Metal supports stood up like thick columns at intervals. The globe above their heads was hollow, else not even the tough, reinforced steel of the tower could have supported its weight. They could not see the sphere. 9 feet above their heads, the ceiling was plated with thickness after thickness of Ardath's alloy, the only thing that would halt the radiation of atomic energy. Court fumbled with a televisor. "Wish I'd finished this weeks ago," he complained. "Ardath showed me how to build it, but I didn't have time. Let's see." The screen ran riot with color that swiftly faded into a uniform gray. "Trying for China?" Marion asked, coming to stand close to Court. He nodded. "The other tower. I'm getting it. Here it is." On the screen, the fat, butter-colored face of Li Yang appeared. The beady black eyes stared.
"Court? Hello! How's the work?"
"All finished," Court sighed. "We're just waiting for you. Bolted the last connection half an hour ago."
"Fine," the Oriental applauded. "We'll be ready tomorrow, perhaps sooner. Wait a moment. Here's Ardath."
The Kyrian's thin, ascetic face replaced that of Li Yang. His eyes were red-rimmed with fatigue.
"So, you're finished, Court," he said. "Good. My workmen were not much slower. We'll be done in a few hours, not tomorrow, Li Yang. Then we can turn on the power."
"Don't forget," Ardath's lips thinned, "we must be careful. Both of us must turn on the switches at exactly the same moment, otherwise there will be disaster. The atomic screen must meet just halfway around the Earth. If you turn on your power too soon, your energy screen will smash mine back and destroy this tower completely. We must be completely accurate."
Court glanced at an instrument panel near him. "I will. Wait a minute. Someone's coming up in the elevator."
The warning bell was ringing. Presently, the lift rose into view. An overalled figure, half hidden under the weight of a wooden box, stepped out of the cage. Scipio turned from where he had been leaning on the rail and staring down into the black gulf. He peered at the workman. Marion's brows drew together in puzzlement.
"What's this?" she asked. "We didn't—"
The box fell crashing to the floor. The face of the man behind it was revealed. It was no longer bearded, clean-shaven now and with the hair bleached yellow. Yet the arrogant mouth, hawk nose, and the tawny amber eyes could belong to only one man, Thordred. His hand went up, a lens blinking bluely in it. The mouth gaped in a snarl.
"Don't move!" His voice shook with mad fury. "Don't move a muscle! I've come back!"
Court still stood before the televisor. On the screen he saw Ardath's face watching, immobile and intent. He glimpsed a heavy wrench that was lying forgotten on the ledge of the televisor. It was hidden from Thordred's view by the instrument's bulk. Court let his hand gently close over it.
"Don't be a fool," he said. "You can't possibly escape."
Thordred laughed harshly.
"No, you saw to that. Your police have come after me. If I hadn't stolen your memories, I'd never have escaped them. I disguised myself as a workman and rode up here. Nobody stopped me. And I have a weapon now. I made it with the knowledge and memories I took from Ardath."
Marion's face was paper white. Scipio stood motionless, his gigantic hands gripping the rail behind him.
"What do you intend to do?" Court asked.
"Kill you," Thordred rasped. "Then I'll turn on the power. I know how to do that, and the energy will destroy Ardath in his tower. With you two out of the way, I can rule the Earth. My brain, with the combined knowledge of yours and his, is wiser than any other in the world."
"You may do that," Court admitted, warily watching for an opening. "But what about the plague?"
"I haven't forgotten that. The towers can be repaired. The Earth shield can be created, even without you and Ardath. But then I shall rule this planet."
Softly, without moving his lips, Court whispered into the televisor,
"Turn on your power, Ardath. It'll destroy Thordred. We'll go with it, but that's the only way."
The Kyrian did not speak, but he shook his head slightly. Thordred moved forward, the blue lens in his hand lifted.
"Now," he said, "now you die."
Court's muscles tensed for a hopeless leap. He knew he could not reach the other in time. His fingers tightened over the wrench. Scipio had not moved. His eyes were aglow. Murder lust sprang into Thordred's dark face. He aimed the crystal.
"Thordred!"
Ardath's voice rang out from the televisor. Startled,
Thordred involuntarily glanced toward the instrument. Simultaneously on the screen, a beam of blinding white light flashed from Ardath's hand. It flamed into Thordred's eyes, blinding him. Roaring, the giant shook his head, a ray of blue radiance spearing wildly from the lens he held. Kort snatched up the wrench and hurled it with all his strength. It struck Thordred's hand. The lens was hurled away, to shatter on the metallic floor. Ready to hurl himself at Thordred, Kort was halted by Scipio's bull voice. The Carthaginian roared, "Back, Kort! He is mine! Mine to slay!" No longer blinded by the ray, Thordred turned to face this new menace. With the snarl of a cornered beast, he closed with his attacker. The mighty, hair-covered hands closed about Scipio's throat. The Carthaginian tore them away, and the two men gripped each other about the waist. They reeled back and forth, each striving to throw the other. To and fro on the platform they wrestled, hundreds of feet above the ground. Staggering to the railed brink and back, Thordred bellowed with insane rage. His mouth gaped open as he sought to sink his teeth into Scipio's throat. The Carthaginian swung his fist in a short arc. The power of the blow brought blood gushing from Thordred's cheek. Kort and Marion, and on the screen Ardath and Li Yang, watched the two titans battle. The men were well matched. Thordred was taller, but Scipio seemed to weigh a trifle more. Yet the raging, murderous frenzy that filled them both was exactly equal. Abruptly, Thordred drove a foul blow at Scipio's middle. The Carthaginian grunted, and his guard dropped for a moment. Instantly, Thordred hurled himself upon his opponent. The two went down, Thordred on top. The hairy hands again sank into Scipio's corded throat. Kort sprang forward, the wrench in his hand. Scipio turned his head slightly. His deep voice roared a warning. "Back, Kort! He is mine to slay!" Then the iron hands of the gladiator from Carthage found their mark, the throat of the savage from the earth's youth. And they sank deep, deep. All the tremendous strength in Scipio's muscles seemed to flow into his arms. Cords and knots stood out under his bronze skin. Thordred's face was suddenly gorged with purple. Blood stained his shaved chin, began trickling down. Desperately, he strove to throttle his opponent. Abandoning the effort, he released his grip and stabbed his fingers down at Scipio's eyes. The Carthaginian expertly rolled his head, and the foul missed its mark. Thordred was suddenly clawing at the terrible hands that shut off his breath. His body jerked and writhed like a hooked fish. His eyes were distended and protruding. Frantically, he tried to tear himself free, and could not.
"You left her to die,"
Scipio whispered.
Kort knew that he spoke of Jansaya, the Atlantean priestess.
One last, frightful effort Thordred made. Something snapped with a brittle, crackling report. Simultaneously, the giant flung himself up with one uncoiling motion. He stood upright, amber eyes glaring, breath hissing and rattling into his starved lungs. Suddenly, the huge head lolled forward slackly on its broken neck. For a heartbeat, Thordred stood silhouetted against the dark sky. Then he crashed, lifeless, to the floor. Scipio sprang up. He heaved up the heavy body of Thordred and went staggering toward the railing. He flung the body out into the abyss and stared after it with brooding eyes.
"Your vengeance, Jansaya," he whispered, "and mine."
Then Scipio Agricola Africanus, the man from Carthage, put his head down on his arms. He began to weep great, choking sobs that ripped harshly from his throat. Kort looked away in sympathy and walked toward the televisor screen. Against it, Marion leaned, faint with reaction. Both Ardath and Li Yang were watching.
Though the Oriental's gross yellow face was immobile, his lacquer eyes were suddenly aglow with pity.
"Oh," Li Yang sighed softly, "alas for such men as Scipio, who find neither thrones nor love."
Ardath turned when a man appeared behind him on the screen. After a few words, he faced Court.
"The work has been done sooner than I expected. We can turn on the power now. Compare your chronometer with mine."
The two delicate timepieces checked precisely.
"At exactly 11, throw your switch," Ardath instructed. "I shall do the same."
They were 10 seconds to go. 5, 3. Court's hand trembled on the switch. 2, 1. Now. Deafening thunder bellowed out from the summit of the tower. For miles around, the roaring blast shattered windows and awakened sleepers to panicky fright. White light made the country bright as day. For a second, the maelstrom of raving light and sound continued. Then it swiftly died. There was silence, save for a low humming.
"Good," Ardath said on the screen. "We timed it exactly right. In 2 minutes, watch the sky. If it lights up, we have succeeded."
With one accord, Court and Marion hurried to the railing. Even Scipio lifted his head to stare at the black sky. 2 minutes to wait. The incredible barrier of electrons, the curtain of atomic energy, was rushing around the Earth, spreading out from the points of origin in the twin towers. 1 minute dragged by. Then, without warning, the sky turned white. The dim stars vanished. A curtain of pallid white brilliance hung over the Earth like a shining ivory bowl overturned upon the land. A single heartbeat it remained, and then faded and was gone. But Court knew that the Earth shield had been created. That barrier would forever safeguard mankind.
"We've won!" His voice was hoarse with triumph. "Marion, we've saved humanity!"
There was something inexpressibly tender in the girl's eyes as she watched him. For now she knew that Stephen Court was a man whom she could love and cherish, not a cold, inhuman machine. In the hour of his triumph, he exulted not because he had solved a terrible problem with his keen brain. Court rejoiced because he had saved human beings from horror and death.
"Yes," Marion said softly. "We've won, Steve. Both of us have won what we wanted."
From the metallic sphere overhead, invisible energy flared out, challenging the stars, as it poured its mighty power into the Earth shield. Epilogue. 1 year later, a little group stood on the Wisconsin hills, examining a huge golden spaceship that loomed against the green slope and the summer sky. It had taken months to build a new vessel to Ardath's specifications, but at last the task had been finished, the equipment installed, and the provisions taken aboard. In every respect, the craft was a duplicate of the Kyrian original, save for a few new devices which Ardath and Court had perfected. Scipio, Li Yang, and Ardath stood together in the open airlock, Marion and Court a few feet away. It was difficult to find words at this moment of sad farewell.
"I am sorry you will not go with us, both of you," Ardath said after a time. "Yet you may be right." "You know how I feel about it," Court returned. "The plague is destroyed. It will never come again, thanks to the Earth shield. But new dangers may arise. These people among whom I was born are my people. I must be ready to serve and help them. I think that was the reason I was given a mind evolved beyond my time. I can help in so many ways, Ardath. There is so much I can do to improve this world of mine. Already, in 1 year, vast strides have been made. Atomic power has outlawed war. When I die,
I want to die in a utopia that I have helped to build."
Ardath nodded with understanding. "I came through time to find a supermind whom I could abduct to start a new race. Well, I have found that supermind, and you are wiser than I, Stephen Court. We are all part of some cosmic pattern, and this pattern works toward good and not evil. It builds and does not destroy. So I shall go on in my search for a race where I can find kinship and happiness. Perhaps 1,000 years from now I shall stand beside your grave, Court."
"I, too," Scipio broke in. "Your world is a fine one, Court, and some of it I like. But I follow a dream. Mayhap I can carve out a kingdom in some distant future."
He did not finish, but his face was suddenly somber.
"I cannot stay here," he said at last. "Jansaya died here, and that would always be an aching pain in my heart."
"Nor will I remain," Li Yang murmured. "Perhaps it is merely curiosity that impels me to go on with our death. I do not know. But the unknown has a certain fascination, and I am anxious to know what will exist 1,000,000 years from now. So farewell, and—" the tiny mouth twisted grotesquely— "and do not forget fat old Li Yang."
The gross figure turned hastily and disappeared into the ship.
Scipio bent and touched his lips to Marion's brow before he squeezed Court's hand in a mighty grip.
"The gods watch over you," he rumbled, and was gone inside.
Now Ardath's strange, alien eyes dwelt on the faces of Marion and Court.
"There is nothing I can say," he whispered. "Only farewell."
Some indefinable bond of kinship between minds flashed for an instant as Court and Ardath gazed into each other's eyes. Then the Kyrian stepped back into the ship, and the port swung shut. The vessel lifted. It rose silently and dwindled against the blue, a bright golden ovoid that faded to a speck and was out of sight. It sped toward the orbit it would follow around the earth, perhaps for thousands of years, until Ardath and Scipio and Li Yang awoke to follow their strange destiny. Two figures stood close together on the slope. Marion and Court looked up until all trace of the golden ship was gone. There was only the blue sky then and the green hills of Wisconsin. Still silent, and with the man's arm holding the girl's slim form close to him, they turned to retrace their steps to the highway where a car waited. There was nothing they could say, and no need for words had they found any.
The end of The Creature from Beyond Infinity by Henry Cutner. Read by Mark Nelson. This recording is in the public domain.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.